Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Obama was much quoted last week for saying there were glimmers of hope in the economy. Today, in what he's billing as a major economic speech, he's telling the nation that those glimmers are still there, but there are tough times ahead.
2009 will continue to be a difficult year for America's economy, and obviously most difficult for those who've lost their jobs. The severity of this recession will cause more job loss, more foreclosures, and more pain before it ends.
As if to underscore that, economic numbers out today show an unexpected drop in retail sales last month, just when the thinking was that consumers were starting to buy again. Holly Bailey is White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Holly, what are you listening for in the speech?
Well, I think the speech, you know, we didn't really learn anything new from this speech. There was no big major policy announcement. It was really a chance for the president to sort of lay out what the White House has been doing the past 3 months to sort of deal with the bad economy and the way forward. And the one of the things I was looking for was just how the president talked about it. You mentioned that, you know, his much-quoted statement last week that he saw glimmers of hope in the economy. Well, everyone picked up on that statement, but what they didn't pick up was, a few sentences later in which he said, we still have tough times ahead. And so I think what the White House was trying to do with this speech today was sort of walk that fine line while accentuating the fact that, you know, there are signs of progress, but the fact is that it's probably going to get a lot worse before it gets better.
Well, more job losses, more foreclosures, more pain. Pretty succinct in summing it up there. He also is presenting an explainer of how the U.S. got where it is, a perfect storm of irresponsibility and poor decision-making that stretched from Wall Street to Washington to Main Street. We have heard that before, but President Obama in this speech is using some interesting religious imagery. Your thoughts on that, Jesus' Sermon on the Mount?
Right. He brought up the whole analogy about the man who built his house upon the rock versus the man who built his house upon the sand. The man that built his house on the sand obviously had a lot easier, but when the floods came up, as Obama noted in speech, it washed away. And so one of the things he talked about in the speech today was, you know, we want to build the economy on a much more solid foundation, on the rock. And I thought that was very, very interesting. I think that sort of, you know, projects to people, you know, in much more average terms, when we talk about the economy and throw out numbers and scary numbers all the time, but I think that sort of puts it in plain terms where we are today.
Well, I'm wondering, too, I mean, a lot of Americans will automatically start singing the Sunday school song, you know, where
right.
You put your fist together to sing the song. But for some Americans, that's an interesting, you know, religious reference that, well, you know, I'm just wondering what the response to that might be.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something we'll have
right.
to know. I mean, I would be interested in the backstory for, you know, how this sort of came about in the speech and sort of what role directly the president played in writing the speech.
Right. Well, the president has been criticized for not temporarily taking over more failing big banks or removing bank CEOs as he removed GM CEO. Today he said bank takeovers would cost taxpayers more, but did he say anything more than that?
Well, he didn't bring it up much in the speech. I mean, again, there was just talk of what they've done and sort of, laying out the progress ahead. But, not many specifics in the speech today.
And he also outlined what he has done in the past 3 months, passing the $787 billion economic stimulus package and putting out plans to help homeowners. But has he said what more needs to be done?
Well, he sort of is laying the groundwork for asking for more. Again, I think sort of laying out that sort of analogy about building on the rock, he was laying out the groundwork for, you know, coming back to ask for more help. I mean, I think all the speech was about sort of shoring up credibility. You know, the president doesn't have any problems in that department. There was a poll out from Gallup yesterday that showed over 70%, you know, trust him in the economy, which is a number that the White House likes. What they want to keep from happening is, you know, in any way losing some of those numbers and the public losing the patience with President Obama. They want to keep that high. They want to have the public sort of give them a chance to fix this.
Without too much expectation that it's over yet, you know, as you said after last week's comments. Holly Bailey, White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Holly, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, another sign of the times, the demand for H-1B visas has dropped dramatically. Now, these are the special visas that bring foreign and usually highly skilled workers into the U.S. Last year, the agency that oversees the program filled its quota in a week. This year, it still has about 20,000 visas available. That's surely a sign of the bad economy, but maybe a sign of something else as well. Did you see the story over the weekend about the Indian engineer who helped create Facebook while at Harvard and is now a wunderkind at Google, but is living in Canada rather than the U.S. because he could get an H-1B visa, but his highly educated wife would not be allowed to work in the U.S.? For most of this decade, over 100,000 spouses, mostly wives, have come to the U.S. every year when their husbands get H-1B visas. But the wives get H-4s and soon discover that doesn't allow them to work. Meghna Damani was one such H-4 visa holder who had degrees and different careers in India. In 2002, she followed her husband when he received an H-1B, but that fact that she couldn't work quickly caused a rift in the marriage.
You don't take any ownership or accountability.
What ownership do I not take?
Do you even know what we have in our bank account?
It's not my money.
Oh, let's have another conversation some other time.
Abhi, I'd like to finish this conversation.
Meghna Damani's marriage survived, even as we'll hear she almost didn't. Her H-4 visa allowed her to study, so she took a filmmaking workshop and made a film about H-4 spouses. We just heard a scene. Meghna's film is called Hearts Suspended, Losing Who You Were, Losing Who You Could Become. We're also joined by Shivali Shah, an attorney in Washington, D.C., and founding member of Kiran, an organization serving battered immigrant women in North Carolina. We'll hear how they feature in this story. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Robin.
Hi, Robin. Thanks for having us.
Well, it's a pleasure. And Meghna, I want to start with you. You came in 2002. Could you really just explain to us what the cycle is that H-4 visa holders get into? You know, why can't they work?
Well, the H-4 visa by itself is a visa which does not give you a work status. So in order to work, you have to apply for a work visa, which is a H-1 visa. And the process for getting the H-1 is that you have to find an employer who's going to sponsor you for that visa.
So that gives a person with an H-4 visa a disadvantage because I imagine employers don't want to do that extra work to get their status changed. Shivali, what other problems do you see?
Now, the main problem for H-4 visa holders is that while they're in India, they're either working or finishing up studying so that then they could work when they get married and come to the U.S. to join their husbands. You know, in terms of their career, they're thinking, this will be my foot in the door in the U.S., but once I get to the U.S., I'll acclimate for 6-8 months, figure out the lay of the land, and start applying for jobs wherever I'm living. The problem is getting a work visa is not as simple as it seems, and a lot of the people that get visas here don't really share with folks back home how difficult it is, the bargaining, the choices people have to make. The two major barriers are that they cannot work and that they are dependent on their husband for their immigration status. And both of those things separately create various problems for these women as they start their life in the U.S.
Well, Meghna, you illustrate this in the film because it's not just that you're depending on a husband for your finances, which we heard a little bit of a clip where you were asking to, you know, take your documentary maybe to some film festivals and he didn't want to pay for it and you had to rely on him. But you also end up relying on them, I would imagine, for your social circle, for your interaction with the world, because you're not working and you don't know anyone here.
Yes, that's very true. It's like, it's basically you're dependent on them for everything. You know, right at the start of your marriage, that's a lot of pressure. And I did have friends who were here, you know, who I knew from school, but then during the week, all my friends were working. So it would be like this burst of social activity in the weekend with my husband and all of us together. And then on Monday morning, everybody leaves for work. And then what do?
You spent days and nights looking for jobs, didn't get one. Mm-hmm. And it got to the point where, you know, you had thoughts of suicide.
Mm-hmm.
Why? I mean, what? Try to explain, you know, the sort of stranger in a strange land, how you started to feel.
Mm-hmm. Actually, it's important to understand society in India is full of people and color and smells and there's noise and there's a constant, you know, human interaction. And I believe, you know, human beings, we get a lot of sustenance from this kind of constant energy. And when you come into this new world where suddenly, you know, everything is different, And, you know, you're not really going and interacting with anybody. So you're facing your own self in some aspects for the first time. Also, it made me realize that, you know, so much of our lives is defined by what we do. And suddenly, when that's taken away from you, a whole chunk of self-esteem, a whole chunk of confidence is, you know, kind of just snatched away from you very suddenly. But at the same time, you don't realize it immediately, especially for me, because I thought, you know, America is a land of opportunity and it's a land of dreams for everybody outside of America. And so how difficult, you know, could it be to get a job? So, you know, as you go down that process, as I went down that process, and people didn't respond to my resume, and suddenly, you know, these questions of, you know, am I really good enough? Am I really confident enough? Am I not? And so, but it's still, because it's so unspoken, even amongst women on H-4 visas, it was only after when I started making the film and, you know, I heard all their experiences on the blogs that I felt like, okay, this is not me alone. So coming back to your question, totally I was on the H-4 for 5 years. And I think somewhere in towards the end of the second year, and this was like the harshest winter, and I was not used to the winter either. And I was not well for about over a week. And I just spent the whole day in my house crying. And I remember like looking out of the window and I saw this little girl, you know, with a balloon, smiling and happy. And, you know, it was like being in a cage, just looking out at life. Like, you're always a spectator. Like, everything is happening outside of you and you're not part of it. Mm. And suddenly it just struck me that, you know what, I can't remember the last time I've been happy or the last day that I haven't cried. All of that just mounted itself, and I actually called up the suicide helpline, and because I was considering, you know, just killing myself, because nothing made sense at that point.
Well, thanks for, you know, talking about that, and we're awfully glad, you know, you're here to talk about that. And Shivali, how widespread is this, and how often do you hear stories of such despair? I mean, what are some of the other things that happen when wives can't work?
If we think about, you know, a woman who's come to the U.S. is frustrated with her situation, possibly this situation is causing tensions in the marriage, it's very difficult to, A, speak with your old friends and family back in your home country, because they're looking at you and saying, how great is your life? You know, they're seeing all the American movies, they're seeing their other friends leaving and sending back wonderful gift items and photos of their fabulous life, and they're thinking, well, how hard can your life be? For the new friends that they've created here, for most of these women, back in 2003, I'd conducted a survey of 100 H4 women, and the majority of them, when asked whether they had female friends in the U.S., they first said yes. When asked the later question, do you have female friends that are not the wives of your husband's friends, the answer was mostly no. The wives of the husband's friends are not very helpful in this situation. There comes down this veil of quiet, of, you know, please let's not talk about this, let's not open this, and if I talk to you about it, then I could get blamed for whatever is being stirred around in your marriage, and it becomes very difficult.
That's attorney Shivali Shah. She and Meghna Damani have been telling us about H-4 visa holders, spouses who follow their husbands to the U.S. but are not allowed to work. When we come back, does the system lead to domestic abuse? And later, the disappearing sounds of a pod of killer whales. Back in just 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We've been speaking about H-4 visas. Now, these go to the spouses, usually wives, of the H-1B special work visa holders. But H-4s make it very difficult to work in the U.S. Meghna Damani made a film about her experience as an H-4 visa holder. And Shivali Shah is an attorney in Washington, D.C. and an advisor to H-4 visa holders. Shivali, H-4 workers, as we said, can't get work. They're socially isolated. But what other practical obstacles do they face?
In a lot of states, it's very difficult for an H-4 to get a driver's license, and none of them get Social Security cards. You cannot get a bank account. there's so many ways of interacting with the outside world that we take for granted that these women cannot have unless their husbands give it to them. Like everything that I have in my wallet, my driver's license, my social security card, my health insurance card, even the cash and the credit cards I have, an H4 woman would only have because her husband gave it to her or allowed her to have it. She's very isolated from the outside world. And then when you think back to the driver's license issue, it's very difficult to imagine from sitting in India or China or Honduras and all the other countries from which H4s come, how deadly quiet suburban life is. And if you're not living in a city with public transportation, you really, really need a car to get around.
Well, and that isolation for women who don't want it and don't expect it is sort of a petri dish for domestic abuse. And we understand, Shivali, that you're a founding member of a group that advises South Asians. And that's where you first encountered battered women who are on the H-4 visa and got them some protection. What protection do they have now?
Well, the organization you're talking about is Kieran in North Carolina. We found that a disproportionately high number of our clients were either on the H-4 visa or they now had green cards, but they came to the U.S. on H-4s, and the domestic abuse started very soon after they got here. The thing that we were able to do after much lobbying is to get work authorization for that group of H-4 women who are in domestic violence situations.
They're now covered under the 2005 version of the Violence Against Women Act. There's a provision now that grants them work authorization.
Right. While that's a great step, it does not include those who are, you know, like in Meghna's situation, who are, you know, they're having various other issues, but the relationship with her husband is still very good. This only covers the women that are in very severely deteriorated relationships, and, you know, there's lots of reasons why immigrant women in general will not want to admit to domestic abuse, and then for these particular women, again, you know, back in their home countries, the type of husband that they're married to, the H-1B who's in India, they're definitely considered the golden boys of India who are praised all around the world for having really pushed the high-tech boom in the U.S. It's very difficult to tell people at home that your highly educated husband with a great salary is not treating you well.
Meghna Damani, what do you say to Americans who might say, I feel badly that you're isolated, but I don't want more people coming in and taking away American jobs? Obviously, your husband was brought in because some employer felt that he needed those skills, but then why should you go take a job that another American could do?
This is a question I also ask myself a lot. And I really do believe that it is possible to have an economy where everybody can have jobs. It's just a basic human right. I mean, it's there in the Declaration of Human Rights, the right to work.
Well, and I'm imagining too, Shivali, you would say that if these women go down the paths of the depression or, you know, even suicidal thoughts or domestic violence, they become a real burden on American society.
I don't even think the argument needs to be even taken that far. I mean, as a preliminary matter, it's just outrageous that we would invite the men to work in the U.S., but ask them to make these horrible choices in their family, to either bring a wife over as a housewife or to have her stay in her home country and have the kind of career and life that she wants, but then her husband is across the sea. Now, if we look at every other developed country, when they have highly skilled workers into their country, every other developed country allows their spouses to work. And you're asking these women to choose between having a husband and a family and having a career. I mean, this is a choice that women in the U.S. in the 21st century should not have to make. Now, the first thing that I always hear from congressmen, from other stakeholders that could be helpful in this is the same question you asked, Robin. If we give these women jobs, they're going to be taking jobs away from hardworking Americans. Well, I'm not saying that when they land here they should be given a job. Let them compete with everybody else. The barrier to getting the work visa is so much higher. Most Americans would not qualify.
That's Shivali Shah. She works with women affected by the H-4 visa law. And Meghna Damani has made a film about her experience as a spouse who followed her husband to the United States and got an H-4 visa. The film is called Hearts Suspended, Losing Who You Were, Losing Who You Could Become. You can find out more about it at our website, here-now.org. And Meghna and Shivali, I want to thank you both for talking to us.
Thank you so much.
Well, we want to note in passing two passings. Former All-Star pitcher Mark the Bird Fidrich has died at 54, apparently while repairing a truck on his farm in the town where he grew up, Northborough, Massachusetts. He pitched 5 magical seasons with the Detroit Tigers in the 70s. Bob Bryan is the Boston Globe sports columnist. Bob, what will you remember the most?
That in a game where people erroneously say that it's just a kid's game, when in fact it's a highly exacting game, Mark Fidrich was the one exception. To him, it was a kid's game. Right. He brought a joy to the game that I have never seen in all the years I've covered baseball.
Yeah. He looked like Big Bird from Sesame Street, and he talked to the ball.
He was talking to himself through the ball. He rearranged the dirt on the pitcher's mound. And really, the game that caught the nation's fancy was right in Fenway Park. And then he went on to start the All-Star game in 1976, won 19 games, and was on his way to a great career when he injured his knee and was never the same again. But let me tell you, he was a unique phenomenon. I really believe I've never seen anything quite like it in baseball.
Bob Bryan, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, in addition, Harry Callis, the voice of the Philadelphia Phillies, collapsed in the booth yesterday and later died. Somebody stole the Liberty Bell today is the headline in the Philadelphia Inquirer. With a nod to his favorite saying, Harry Callis is out of here at 73.
The 0-2 pitch, swing and a miss, struck him out. The Philadelphia Phillies are 2008 World Champions of Baseball.
Arrest warrants were issued today in Thailand for more than a dozen protest leaders, including the ousted Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra. This follows the end of demonstrations in Bangkok that left 2 people dead and more than 120 injured. Jonathan Head is the BBC's South Asia correspondent in Bangkok. Jonathan, help us understand this. The protesters called off the demonstrations. The government they were protesting even provided buses for them to go home. You say this died down surprisingly quickly. What happened?
The army was much more effective than many people thought in containing these protesters and driving them back. We had some really very, very violent scenes at the beginning of the first clashes with the army. The army had been brought in because the Prime Minister declared a state of emergency. He wasn't confident the police could deal with it, and everyone was worried. But the army became more confident, drove these protesters back, and had them effectively penned in at a camp where they've been for the past 3 weeks and sealed it off. Nobody else could come in, and they allowed people to leave, and their numbers just dwindled. Yeah. The odds really built up against them, and we did think they might try to fight. They were certainly prepared for it. They had barricades and petrol bombs prepared, but their leaders said, look, there's no point in having more casualties, and the key leaders then turned themselves over to the police.
Well, these protesters are the so-called red shirts. They backed the former prime minister who was ousted in a military coup in 2006. And we also remember last year the yellow shirt protesters who shut down Bangkok's 2 main airports. Red shirts, yellow shirts. What's the difference?
The yellow shirted protesters who came out last year are ultra-royalists. Yellow is the colour of the king, who's revered in Thailand, but very much the focus of the traditional establishment, the people who've become wealthier through Thailand's economic development, elite bureaucrats, top members of the army. They're all people who think of themselves as closely aligned to the monarchy, and they felt their way of life and the traditional way things are done in Thailand was endangered by the ousted prime minister you mentioned, Mr. Thaksin, and his red-shirted followers, who are much more grassroots. They represent more of the rural poor and want more rapid social change in Thailand. Last year, we had a government led by allies of Mr. Thaksin, and so the yellow shirts were able to drive his governments from power. He was charged with corruption while he was in exile and indeed convicted by the courts, although the red shirts say this was unfair. Those charges and those yellow-shirted protesters, who had a lot of backing from the army and other elite circles, really made it impossible for Mr. Thaksin's allies to govern last year. And that's what brought the current government into office. And this is a government much more aligned to the royalist yellow side. So now the Reds have come out and said, we'll give you a taste of your own medicine. But they have come up against the army. Last year, the army refused to move against the yellow protesters. This time, they have moved very effectively against the Reds, but I don't think they've solved it, because this fundamental split between red and yellow, between people who think of themselves as the disadvantaged poor and those who represent the establishment, that split's still there.
Well, and what do you expect to happen next?
I think it's very worrying because there is so little consensus. In the old days in Thailand, if there was any kind of dispute between people in power, either the army would step in decisively, and we used to have a lot of military governments here in the 60s and 70s in Thailand, or the king would step in with a sort of judgment of Solomon and adjudicate and persuade the two sides to come together. The king is now very old. He's 81 years old, and so the monarchy doesn't have that ability to act as arbitrator now. And these two sides seem incapable of finding common ground. And of course, that has huge impact, a huge impact on Thailand's future economy, on investor confidence, and increasingly on tourists who want to come here.
Well, and we were going to ask, it is a huge tourist destination. Is it having an impact right now?
Tourism has held up remarkably well through these last 3 years of turmoil, mostly because it's really had an impact on the tourists. The only time it really did was December last year when the Yellow Shirts, the rival protesters, took over the main international airport and shut it down. That had a big impact. We had hundreds of thousands of people stranded here. Right now, there are warnings from embassies in place saying that you shouldn't come to Thailand, certainly if you've been caught up anywhere where these clashes were going on in the last 28, 36 hours. It would have been a dangerous place to be, and yet there are large parts of Bangkok that have been completely unaffected. We get something like 12 to 13 million tourists coming to this country every year. Analysts are saying if this kind of turmoil continues, inevitably tourists will start to worry about being here and choose alternative destinations.
The BBC's Jonathan Head speaking to us from Bangkok, Thailand. Jonathan, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, before we go today, finding Dolly Parton, Jerry Lee Lewis, Hank Williams Jr. in an old barn? We'll explain. Back in a bit, here and now. Welcome back. In our reporting last month on the 20th anniversary of the Exxon Valdez oil spill, we learned that many marine mammal species in Prince William Sound, Alaska, are recovering from the effects of that accident, but that a community of killer whales, unlike any other in the world, is doomed in part because of the spill. There were 22 AT1 pod whales before the spill. 9 of them died shortly after, likely from ingesting oil. And there are now only 7 left, including 2 females. But there have been no new calves born since the spill. And when the last of these whales is gone, so too will be their calls that echo through Prince William Sound. Craig Matkin joins us. He's director of the North Gulf Oceanic Society in Homer, Alaska. He's been studying the region's whales for 3 decades. And Craig, first of all, tell us about this unique killer whale, the AT1 pod.
Well, this is a population of transient whales. They roam the sound in small groups. And this particular transient group is unique from all others. They produce calls that are unlike any other killer whale calls in the world. And their genetic makeup is different than any others, and it indicates they don't breed with other whales. So it's a very, very small population.
Well, you mentioned the sounds, and that being something that sets them apart. And you've sent us a sample. This is a sequence of songs where 2 whales from this pod are trying to locate each other, and they eventually come together. Let's listen. Craig Matkin, that is just such a plaintive sound. Now, I don't want to get all anthropomorphic on you.
I don't blame you. I hear that, and it just gives me chills, and I've heard it 100 times, you know. And those calls are something that I associate with the sound. They're like the fabric of Prince William Sound. And to feel that those calls someday will disappear completely, I have to say, I get real emotional about it. It's hard for me to listen to those calls and not get the the shivers.
Well, and you've said that that's what sets these whales apart from even other, you know, whales, because every whale, every pod has a different, you know, dialect, has its own dialect. But you say that these whales, they have practically an entirely different language.
Yeah, it is. There's scientific papers out that we've done on this, and I could play other killer whale calls all afternoon, and you would hear nothing like this.
Well, let's listen to the difference between the AT1 killer whales and other pods. We'll start with the AJP pod killer whale and follow with the call of the AT1 killer whale. So there's a comparison for you. We want to hear more from the AT1s, which, Craig, we understand are usually quiet but become very vocal after hunting. But before we hear more, what are we picturing? Is this Shamu? You know, what do they look like?
Well, they look like the killer whales you see in captivity. They're a little stockier than some of those you'd see in captivity, maybe a little bit shorter. They have the black and white coloration. They have the gray saddle patch and the taller dorsal fin in the males. We use the dorsal fin and the marks on the saddle patch to identify every individual, just like you do faces of people. So we're keeping track of every individual over the years. That's why we know who's born and who's died and if there's a new calf. So really unique, distinctive black and white animals that can weigh up to 12,000 pounds or so, with the males anyway. Large animals, but not like a humpback whale or the larger whales.
Right. Well, let's play some calls that you've sent us, and then you tell us what they mean.
That's a contact call. That's the really loud siren-like call they give when they're trying to make contact with other animals a long distance away.
Okay, let's hear another one.
Yeah, that's more of a call they'll make when they're closer together that keep track of each other.
Okay, another one.
Another social call that they use. After they make a kill, they'll use a lot of calls like this. They indicate an excited state, and they're communicating with each other.
Well, and by the way, people love these animals, but seals don't. They're going after seals. What else are they hunting?
Dull's porpoise as well. The dull's porpoise is the really fast black and white porpoises. And I think harbor seals are a little easier for them to get. But harbor seals have declined in recent years, so there's been more pursuit and attacks on dull's porpoise.
Let's hear another sound.
That's the kind of call you often hear in response to the whale that initiates the contact calls.
Wow, that was beautiful. I mean, that sounded like an instrument.
They do. They do sound like an instrument. And my partner in this work, Eva Salidis, started this study of their calls, plays the oboe, and she used to play the oboe out on the water. And sometimes it was really startling how similar these kind of calls would be to some of the sounds you could make on the oboe.
Well, so now seven of these majestic animals left. You say nine of them died immediately after the Exxon Valdez spill, maybe from ingesting oil. But do we know that this pod of only 22 would have been reduced anyway? Do we know, the seal population has been getting smaller. Do we know why they're so diminished?
No, we don't know why they're so diminished. They were at a stable level of 22 individuals for a number of years before the spill. But basically, I think the spill has, sort of put the final nail in the coffin for these guys. And while we had two reproductive females and two juveniles that died at the time of the spill, and that really took away any hope of recovery.
The tipping point. Well, is there anything that can be done?
I don't think it's really practical to talk about taking them in captivity and doing some sort of captive breeding program. We just hope that the last couple females might have calves.
Meanwhile, if they don't, I mean, we began by saying you just can't even bear to think of not having the sound in the water, but you might have to.
Yeah, and it's just strange because I never would have thought I'd be working with an animal that I could potentially see go extinct in my lifetime. And it's sort of a chilling feeling, and it brings home this idea of extinction, which we read about how many species are going extinct all over the world. It brings it right home and makes it a very emotional and sort of a gut-wrenching concept.
Craig Mackin, director of the North Gulf Oceanic Society, speaking to us from KBBI Radio in Homer, Alaska. Craig, thanks so much and best of luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Welcome back to Here and Now.
Your cheating heart.
That's Hank Williams Jr. sitting in with his dad's old band, and it comes from a gold mine of country music discovered in an old barn in Pennsylvania. Reel-to-reel recordings of high school dances and county fairs in Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Maryland, most of them in the late 60s and 70s, but also as far back as the 40s. Jay Franzi is an audio engineer who splits his time between Nashville and Massachusetts, and he's carefully transferring these old tapes to digital files. The recordings will eventually hit the auction block and maybe the Country Music Hall of Fame. Jay Franzi joins us in the studio with more of their marvelous story. Welcome.
Thank you.
And this is such a, the story is a country song. As I understand it, there were rumors about the existence of these tapes.
Yeah, the rumors went on for years. From what I was told, the producer, Richard Pittman, told me the story about these tapes being lost in this barn.
Well, and how did he find out? He has a flat tire and...
He actually had a flat tire on the highway driving through Pennsylvania. And the person who changed his tire eventually became a friend of his. And about a year or two later, they were talking one day about these mystery tapes, and the guy who changed his tire actually knew of the tapes.
So Richard Pittman, the producer who subsequently hired you, he says, go get those tapes. How many tapes were there?
I'm going to guess about 1,000.
Wow, I heard 2 pickup trucks.
Yes, 2 pickup trucks full of tapes.
And the owner, the new owner of this old barn thought, you know, take away those old dusty tapes. What were they? What are they?
They're just old reel-to-reel tapes, quarter-inch tapes.
Who recorded them?
Ken Alexander. He was a live sound engineer, and while he was doing these live shows, he actually recorded them down to quarter-inch tape here.
He ran a sound company in Dry Run, Pennsylvania.
Yes.
Gotta love the name of that town. I mean, it's all a song. It's a country song. The whole story is a song. Well, let's listen to another one of the jewels that you've uncovered. This is John Hartford's Good Old Electric Washing Machine. It was recorded in Culpeper, Virginia in 1972.
Well, I sure do miss that good old electric washing machine. The one that we ain't got round here no more. And I sure do miss that big round tub and them stomping, swinging sounds. And I miss them groovy puddles on the floor.
Now, Jay Franzi, what was it like the first time? Actually, you've got some of these reel-to-reels here. Can you pass them over to me? Because
sure.
These are, and I don't know if I should even touch them. We can picture the box, Scotch magnetic tape. It's like from the Paleozoic era. It's like something that belongs in a museum. And here's a little typed-out label on it. Tammy Wynette, Carl Smith, and Doc Williams. And here's the tape inside. Now, this tape looks like it's in good shape. Imagining a lot of the tape wasn't.
Most of it was in pretty good condition, actually.
Oh, really?
You can only imagine it being in a barn for 40 years through the summer of the winter, and still being able to be played to this day.
It smells. It's got that musty.
It smells like tape.
Well, if anyone still has their old reel-to-reel tapes, you know, they it's old, you know. What was it like the first time you queued one up and played it?
Well, we didn't even know if it would play.
Yeah.
We put it on. Some of them were stuck together. Some of them were a little tight. But after a little bit of maneuvering, we actually got them to play, and it sounded beautiful. It sounded great.
Let's listen to another sample. This is Jerry Lee Lewis, Great Balls of Fire, Gettysburg, PA, 1972.
Yeah! Shake my nerves and you rattle my brain. give my love and drive the stud and sing. Broke my wheel, what a thrill. Good in the reef, lit all the fire. I landed love on a falling with bunny. I'm a long woo, now honey. Change my mind, love is fine. Good in the reef, lit all the fire. Baby, feels good.
This is fantastic. I mean, this is so much better than the studio recording. I mean, is that part of the joy of this? These are live performances.
This one was great because this one is different than the rest of them, where he seems to be a little less caring of his performance and his attitude.
Well, let's face it. He's a little more what?
He's a little more drunk.
Yeah. Doesn't he? I mean, he says that, right?
He does say it somewhere in the tape, yes. He tries to hide it, but eventually he lets it go.
What does he say?
He's talking about someone bringing him orange juice on stage, and he's swearing, oh, no, this is juice, it's juice. And then finally he says, okay, fine, I'm drinking.
Okay, well, there you go. Well, tell us about other little insights you get. Because these are live performances, what are some of the other surprises?
They are things I didn't realize is the first tape we transferred was Roy Acuff. And what I didn't realize is just how much talking they did between songs and stories they told and jokes. It was more of a skit than it was actually a concert.
Yeah. You stumble upon a moment where Crystal Gayle sits in on her older sister Loretta Lynn's show.
Yeah, the night before she records her very first album.
It's Crystal Gayle and so many others. Little Jimmy Dickens, as you said, conversations with the audience. Let's listen to a little bit of Little Jimmy Dickens. This is Life Turned Her That Way from Carlisle, Pennsylvania, a concert in 1966.
I have a ballad that I'm sort of partial to. We hope you will enjoy our efforts to do it for you at this time, a song that's called Life Turned Her That Way. If she seems cold and bitter, I beg of you, just stop and consider all she's gone through.
It's a darn good thing, Jay, that you are a country fan.
Well, living the past 10 years in Nashville, you kind of become one.
Yeah. What do you think of this? Ken Alexander, who started all of this?
It's just unbelievable. I have some old pictures. I have some old documentation.
Oh, let me see. I mean, here's a guy who thought enough of these artists to record them. Oh, there's his little soundboard. Oh, my gosh, look at that.
If you think that's funny, here's his rate sheet.
It's a little tiny soundboard with maybe 10 knobs and about 10 faders. It's just a small little thing, like you might use at a high school play. Oh, and here's a typewritten Ken Alexander Studio, Records and Sound Systems in Dry Run, Pennsylvania.
But take a look at the prices.
Oh, my gosh. For a speaker with a multi-cell horn and bi-amp, he charged $1.75. Batteries, cables, wires, connectors, ladders, an extra dollar. And for his work as the sound engineer, $6. He came cheap, but what he left behind, you know, is worth a lot.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Jay Franzi, audio engineer from Wakefield, Massachusetts, but has worked quite a bit in Nashville and is now working very hard to restore these rare recordings of some of the greats of country music. Jay, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Miss Dolly Parton, how about it?
We're holding on, nothing left to hold on to.
By the way, that's Dolly Parton and Porter Wagoner, recorded in Altoona, Pennsylvania in 1969. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
We squeeze the life from every dream, but still go right on bluffing with really nothing left to hold on to.
Oh, why do we keep holding on to nothing left to hold on to?
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.